Welcome, skeptics. Good to see you on a Sunday afternoon. I'm Michael Shermer, the director of the Skeptic Society and the publisher of this Skeptic Magazine, the quarterly publication of the Society, which you get in it. When you join the Society, you get a subscription to the magazine, and we give you the secret decoder ring, the clues to the Da Vinci Code, and the secret handshake. I know it's probably starting to get a little warm in here. I just went and called the physical plant. They're making sure that the air is on in here. The guy was a little skeptical because he said, well, it's cold outside. I said, I know, but a lot of human activity can warm up the environment. Which I thought was appropriate for today. He said he's a global warming skeptic. I said, no. Just some guy on the phone. I don't know. Okay, in 2001, Cambridge University Press came out with a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist by Bjørn Lomborg. And those of you that have been with us for a long time, you know he was here. And his publicist was my publicist for my first book, Why People Believe Weird Things, who had then shifted over to Cambridge. And she said, hey, this is the perfect book for skeptics. The skeptic's in the title, for gosh sakes. This would be a great topic for your lecture series. I thought, yeah, but, you know, this is pretty controversial, so I should have a debate. I'll put him on. And he said, that's fine. I'd love to debate whoever you can get. So I called Greenpeace and the World Watch, World Life, whatever that is, WWF, and all those different groups, and they all turned me down. They said there's no debate, and you know, we don't want to give a platform to this, and so on. And one leading environmentalist, I don't want to mention his names, but his initials are Paul Ehrlich, told me that my reputation in the scientific community would be severely damaged if I actually hosted a debate with Bjørn Lomborg. So of course we did, we had to get my senior editor Frank Mealy to debate him mainly on biodiversity questions, which the book is a little bit weaker on. But there's a whole variety of these topics within the umbrella of environmental problems. And I do think since that time there has come something of a tipping point or flipping point or whatever, a paradigm shift in the science behind this and leading the charge, probably the world's leading scientific environmental scientist and great author is our speaker today, Tim Flannery, who has come all the way from Australia. He's here in a 21-city book tour through America, so he's about halfway through, so he's pacing himself this weekend. So the question is on global warming, is it real, is it human-caused, and what are the effects, what can we do about it? The weather makers, how man is changing the climate and what it means for life on Earth. Dr. Flannery is also the author of The Future Eaters, which is about the effects of human activity in Australia. He's the author of The Eternal Frontier. It's not a Star Trek book. It's about American frontiers and human activity there. Throw 'em Wayleg, which is a terrific book. A Gap in Nature and Astonishing Animals. He's a regular reviewer. If you read the Times Literary Supplement or the New York Review of Books, you often see his reviews and essays there. So with that, please help me welcome Dr. Tim Flannery, The Weathermakers.
Look, thank you all very much for being here today. I must say I feel a little bit guilty having watched that fantastic clip from Richard Dawkins' movie. I think I'm with you. I perhaps prefer to watch the rest of that. But we probably should get onto this other issue of climate change. I'd just like to begin by making a basic point about climate change. It's a pretty simple, old-fashioned problem at heart. It's an air pollution problem. We know how to deal with air pollution. We've dealt with lots of other pollutants very successfully. But this one has eluded our ability to deal with it because it's seen by some as sort of challenging, I guess, the fundamental underpinnings of this global civilization and global society that we all enjoy. I'd like to just begin by thinking about the nature of that air pollution problem. And to do that, we have to understand a little bit about the atmosphere. Now, climate change science and our understanding of how the atmosphere works has undergone a profound revolution over the last couple of decades. It's every bit as far-reaching and significant as the revolution brought by our understanding of continental drift some four decades ago. Some would even argue that it's as profound as the changes brought by Darwin and Wallace's thought thoughts on the way evolution works through natural selection. Whatever the case, one of the great pleasures of my life has been having a ringside seat as to watch this revolution as it's occurred, both through my colleagues and contacts and obviously through the scientific literature. So what I'm going to present to you today is pretty much the latest science on climate change. It includes events up until late 2005 and scientific publications up until then. My book covers that range of time as well, and it really needed to, because you look back on the literature, you see how qualitatively different the newer findings are compared with the stuff that was published even a decade ago. So let's begin by looking at the atmosphere. I hate that word, by the way, the atmosphere. It's just a word that seems to take for granted what is without doubt the most wondrous organ of our planet. Alfred Russel Wallace had a much better term for it. He called the atmosphere the great aerial ocean. And when I think about the atmosphere as an aerial ocean, you can shut your eyes and imagine those currents and eddies within the aerial ocean that bring us the weather, the layers that structure it and bring climate to our planet. And I guess you can see yourself as a little creature crawling along the bottom of the great aerial ocean, dependent on it every bit as much as a fish or any marine creature is on the salty ocean itself. There's a few facts we should get straight about the aerial ocean, though, from the beginning. One is that it's not very big. In fact, it's surprisingly small. It looks big because it's made of gas, and gas is very diffuse. But to get a sense of its mass, you need to imagine compressing that gas down to liquid form so we can compare it, for example, with the oceans. And if you do that, you find that the great aerial ocean, our atmosphere, is about 1/500th the size of the salty oceans. So it's a small organ of our planet, and it's for that reason that air pollution problems have been and will continue to be the great challenges to our civilization for the foreseeable future. The very first of those challenges, of course, was the destruction of the ozone layer in the stratosphere by man-made chemicals, by CFCs. That challenge was brought about by, well, it was the depletion of ozone in the stratosphere, which is total ozone concentration in the atmosphere is about 6 parts per million. So we were dealing with a pollutant that was extremely rare, measured in parts per billion, really. And today, I'll come back to this later, but that problem was dealt with very successfully through an international collaboration. And today we see the ozone hole start to contract again about 20, 25 years after the protocol was signed that eliminated, or at least in large part eliminated, the chemicals that were damaging the ozone layer. Today, with climate change, what we're seeing is pollution by a different class of gases in the atmosphere, the greenhouse gases. The most common of those are measured in parts per thousand, really. So at that point, we are dealing with a much more abundant gas in the atmosphere, which is, gives you some indication of the number of people on the planet, the activity that we're undertaking, and the volume of waste we're putting into this very finite atmosphere. How much waste are we putting into it? Well, this image gives you some sense of that. This is composite satellite image of the world at night, and of course a century ago the world looked nothing like that. It wasn't an incandescent globe blazing into the night sky. It was a beautifully dark globe. The reason it's incandescent today is that there are large numbers of cities on our planet, all of which have access to fossil fuels, and the majority of those lights are supported by burning fossil fuels. In fact, the majority of them are supported by burning coal. And coal is a particularly dirty fossil fuel in terms of its greenhouse gas consequences. Very good quality coal, such as anthracite, is at least 92% carbon. And when you burn coal, those little carbon atoms combine with larger oxygen atoms to form carbon dioxide, and you get a very voluminous waste stream. So burn a tonne of that sort of coal, you get between 3 and 3.5 tonnes of carbon dioxide. So a small atmosphere, a large waste stream coming from all of that extraordinary activity on our planet. And you can see why this air pollution problem is a particularly taxing one for us to deal with. So what are the consequences of these greenhouse gases? Just to look briefly, this is the Michael Mann hockey stick graph. And some of you may have followed the debate over this graph. It deals with 1,000 years of Earth history. along the axis here, and then a century of projections, the 21st century. The red line marks the average. Sorry, now I've touched something that I shouldn't have here.
You can just go to the next slide back, it'll come back.
Oh, okay. I've got it. This one here. Sorry about that. Okay, and then go back. Thank you. Good. Technology and me are not great friends quite often, but anyway. You may remember this. You may have heard the debate about this graph. The key fact is that that red line there represents the average surface temperature of the northern hemisphere of our planet. It was the first real attempt at averaging and trying to obtain that particular measurement, that temperature. It established that the average temperature for that 1,000 years was about 13.7 degrees Celsius. More recent work has shown that that is in fact not quite correct, that the temperature was somewhat lower and temperature was a little bit more variable through that 1,000 years, but it doesn't detract from the point that I'm trying to make, which was that the temperature has been relatively stable through that time. When we get to about 1850, we get to the establishment of the worldwide thermometer grid. So the uncertainty, which is this grey area around those measurements, tends to decline because we're dealing with direct measurements of the surface temperature of the planet. And we also see a little bit of innocent perkiness in the graph. Not continuous, with some up and downs, but nevertheless a small increase in temperature, which I'll come back to later when we look at its consequences. The bit of the graph, though, that inevitably grabs attention are the projections, which you see here. This was the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is really the global authority on these matters. I think this is still, nevertheless, rather conservative, the data, but being widely accepted, it's worth looking at in some detail. The lowest projections here for the end of our century suggests a warming of about an increase of 1.4 degrees above this historic average, 1.4 Celsius. The highest about 5.8, and in the middle about 3.5, 3 to 3.5, a figure that we'll come back to again. Now, those projections have lots of assumptions, that they're based on. These lower projections assume that people will work very hard to reduce greenhouse gases and will be lucky with the way the world's climate system responds. These high projections obviously have pretty much the opposite sort of assumptions. I'd like to just look at temperature on our planet over a longer time scale and with carbon dioxide over a longer time scale. This graph here shows 160,000 years of Earth history, and what you see with the red line is the average surface temperature of the planet plotted through that time. This data comes from ice core records in Greenland and Antarctica and sedimentary records and others. It's all obviously proxy data. No one had thermometers back then. Nevertheless, it's a well-established sort of record. You can see here these are sort of very cold periods. Obviously, these are warmer periods. And what you're seeing there is the great celestial cycles at work. And those great celestial cycles are called the Milankovitch cycles. They have brought ice ages to our planet every 100,000 years or so for the last million years. And in fact, their influence has been felt much further back in time than that. These celestial cycles concern the rotation of the Earth around the Sun, the tilt of the Earth on its axis, and the wobble of the Earth on its axis. And they can conspire to cool or warm our planet by varying very slightly the overall amount of sun's energy hitting the planet, but also the part of our planet that they hit, that energy hits. Now, the carbon dioxide record, this is direct measurements from little bubbles of air trapped in the ice cores, pretty much runs in lockstep with the temperature record. But don't mistake that for CO2 driving the change. What we're seeing here is, again, those great celestial cycles at work, and carbon dioxide is responding to that through time. There is a decoupling, though, between carbon dioxide and the temperature graph, which is this last little bit here. Bill Ruderman would argue, and you may know him, is he speaking here for your... He spoke last year, okay. Would argue that over the last 8,000 years, people have been modifying the biosphere in ways that have wrested control of the planet's climate system from these great celestial cycles. And you see that here with this relatively flat part of the graph here. Here you can see that decline is very typical of the cycles if you go back through a million years. This is the unusual one with the little flat end. And then this little peak here that we looked at on the other graph. But here's CO2 rising, obviously, on this side here. And this is a very compressed amount of time here. When I was born in 1956, CO2 levels were about 310 to 315 parts per million. They're now over 380 parts per million. And there's a few other points on there, but it's important to understand that over the last 50 years, CO2 concentrations in our atmosphere have increased by around about 25 to 30%. And if you look at Ruderman's data and see these relatively tiny increases back here, this part of the graph, having wrested control of the globe's climate system from the celestial cycles, you can see why people are concerned about these greater increases. There are about 30 different greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. The reason I use CO2 here is because it's the most abundant, and the other greenhouse gases are measured in terms of their impact by CO2 units. And also, we know quite a lot about this particular gas. The lowest possible level we can stabilise CO2 is considered about 450 parts per million. We'll come back to that later. That would take a gargantuan effort and change, particularly in this country, if that's to happen. Double pre-industrial levels, 550 parts per million. And business, as usual, so if we just don't address this issue, we'll end up with CO2 levels around about here by the end of the century. Where is the CO2 coming from? We'll look at transport separately, perhaps in question time, but I'm particularly interested in electricity generation, because I think once you change stationary power, it becomes relatively easy to reform transport, whereas the reverse doesn't apply. So I tend to concentrate on stationary power. Brown coal, you don't have a lot of brown coal in America, thank heavens. We have heaps of it in Australia, and it's the most shockingly polluting fuel. The reason it's so bad is it's very wet. It's very poor quality wet coal, and you've got to dry it out before you can put it into the furnaces to make your electricity. The single most polluting power station on Earth is in Australia, in the brown coal area. And I'm very ashamed to admit to you that per capita, Australians are worse polluters of greenhouse gases than Americans. So we deserve a good spanking. Anyway, I don't know who's going to administer it, but anyway. So here is black coal, quite a bad pollutant. As I explained, burn a tonne of pure carbon, you get 3.7 tonnes of carbon dioxide, and black coal can be pretty close to pure carbon. Natural gas is much less polluting. It's the least polluting of the fossil fuels because it has a fair proportion of hydrogen in it compared with the carbon. It's widely considered a bridging fuel towards the low emissions economy, which is why so much gas infrastructure is going in around the world for electricity generation and why motor vehicles are now being driven increasingly by gas. There's a whole series of technologies that I've just listed a few of here which have very little implication for greenhouse gas emissions. Of course, when you build a solar panel today, you've got to use electricity derived from burning fossil fuels. So there is some implication, but overall not very much. And some of these are, I think, very, very promising indeed. Solar thermal technologies, which are a sort of a solar-based technology, but which can be built on the scale that wind can be built. Biomass, we've heard lots about that, even from George Bush recently. Wind power, nuclear power, geothermal power, again an underestimated resource, and solar panels. They're just a few. But when I look at a graph like this, what I think about is what the internet brought to world media. You know, before the internet came along, Encyclopedia Britannica was going along quite happily, you know, and so was a lot of other media. All of a sudden they were brought into competition with each other. And competition is a key factor in sort of reforming the media as we know it today. At the moment, transport fuels are driven by long-chain hydrocarbons, by and large. Stationary energy is driven by coal, and these other players haven't really had access into the market on a large scale. That will change over the next decade, I'm sure, and we'll see competition between the transport fuels and the stationary energy sources. We'll see competition between all of these new forms of energy generation, and in a carbon-constrained world, that has the potential to absolutely revolutionise the way we generate power. It's important to understand that the atmosphere has some other characteristics that we need to be aware of as we try to understand climate change. One of them is a term I hesitate to use here, but the atmosphere is truly telekinetic. The reason I hesitate to use it is I know you guys and Uri Geller haven't been the best of friends over time, and probably the last time you heard about telekinesis was when good old Uri Geller was bending spoons and causing all sorts of trouble around the world. But telekinesis does have a proper scientific meaning. It means action at a distance without a visible means of connection. And the atmosphere is telekinetic because of the pressure waves that allow it to self-organise around the planet can change instantaneously, virtually, in response to forcing. And we now know that as we warm our planet, we can force changes in the atmosphere that allow global change to occur certainly within 1 year. Climatologists refer to these events as magic gate years, at least some climatologists do. We just need to recap so a little bit here. We've had greenhouse gases. They warm our atmosphere. Now, I haven't explained how that happens. I suppose I should briefly recap that just in case there's some people here who don't understand. The greenhouse gases capture heat energy close to the surface of the planet. Sunlight can pass through the atmosphere without interference. Once it hits the surface of our planet and is transformed into heat energy, though, that heat energy radiates back into space. The greenhouse gases capture that heat energy and re-radiate some of it back to the surface of our planet. Each of the gases interferes with a different wavelength of heat energy. So you can imagine the greenhouse gases as a sort of window panes, really. And as you stop each one up, obviously you darken the interior. As we add to all of those greenhouse gases separately in the atmosphere, we're increasing the heat burden of our planet quite substantially. In 2005, a real landmark paper was published by James Hansen and others quantifying precisely what the heat imbalance of the surface of our planet now is. It's about 0.85 of a watt per square metre. It's about as much energy as you get from burning four little Christmas lights that you put on your Christmas tree. It seems like a small amount, but over time, that build-up of heat energy is, as I'll show, transforming our planet. Now, I put this slide up because 1976 was such an unusual year climatically that National Geographic Society devoted a bit of time to it in their magazine pages, and this was the banner for that particular article. And I'd just like to have a look at a couple of phenomena that occurred in 1976 to give us some sense of how these magic gate years affect life on planet Earth. There's 2 years we need to keep in mind, 1976, a well-understood year, and 1998. The time that's elapsed since 1998 hasn't been as great, so we can't be certain about how permanent some of the changes that occurred then are, but I'll put up some data so you can at least get a sense of the situation. These examples are mostly drawn from Australia, and that's not because Australia was uniquely affected or impacted, it's just that that's where I work and research and I can stand by these figures and defend them for you, which I couldn't necessarily do if I was dragging data from other parts of the world. What we have here is a graph just showing annual stream flow into Perth's water supply dams. Now, Perth is Australia's western city. People worry about water in Perth because to the north is desert and to the south is ocean. It's in a little corner of our continent that does get enough rain to support a city. It's a city of 1.5 million people. What you see here is flow into the catchments from 1911 through to about 2002. And you can see up to 1976, there was about 340 gigalitres of water on average running into those catchments. There's a huge amount of variability year to year. Obviously, Australia's climate's highly variable, but nevertheless, that was the average over time. In 1976, that dropped substantially. In fact, it halved. So in that year, or from then on, the average was 164 gigalitres. Perth's water engineers started to worry by the late 1970s at this phenomenon. Thank heavens the city sits on a large aquifer, and the water engineers started to penetrate that aquifer for water use in the city. And that's been good for about 30 years or so. Unfortunately, the phenomenon that brought the reduced stream flow also brought reduced recharge to the aquifers. So the city is now facing a genuine water crisis where they're building a desalinization plant at the cost of about $350 million that'll provide about 10% of the city's citizens with water. The little red line there shows you 1998, the second magic gate year. We've seen a reduction in stream flow to now a third of what it was just 30 years earlier. So what happened when this phenomenon manifested itself? It seems that Hadley cell circulation in the atmosphere was altered in such a way that the low pressure system, the winter rainfall bearing weather systems, shifted between about 80 to 100 miles south during that year. So a lot of rain was falling over the Southern Ocean and not so much over Perth. The total decrease in rainfall over Perth was only about 10 to 15%. But the nature of those rainfall events, the time of year that they fell, and increased soil temperatures were sufficient to halve stream flow. It's pretty typical of what you see in these biological systems, that small changes are amplified into much larger changes. These are called positive feedback loops. They seem to characterise very much the way the atmosphere works, and you see them quite often in biological systems. I should just point out that this sort of phenomenon, again, has been seen in many parts of the world, but this is one that's particularly well studied and one well understood. I wish I could show you a map of the United States that looked a bit like this. I actually tried to do it. I went online. This is obviously Australia, and those coloured zones show you variation in rainfall over a 53-year period. The US Meteorological Service just doesn't produce a lot of data that's amenable to analysis by climate change researchers, and I don't think that's at all deliberate. I'm sure it's not. I'm sure that the government wouldn't put up with such things. But anyway, at least Australia does produce some data. What you're seeing here with the dark blue areas is areas of Australia where rainfall has increased by 10 inches or more over 53 years. The red areas are areas where rainfall has decreased by 10 inches or more over those same 53 years. Some of this is easily explicable in terms of just the warming of our planet. As the atmosphere warms, the tropical zones, of course, extend south and we get more tropical rainfall. This is the tropical monsoons bringing this rain to northwestern Australia. Unfortunately, that increased rain falls over the Great Victoria Desert, where there are no people living and where evaporation rates are hundreds of times precipitation rates, so it's not done us much good. Most Australians live in this area, which you can see rainfall has declined. Perth, incidentally, is about here, so it's not even in the most severely impacted of the rainfall zones. And as I explained, that declines due to a shift in winter rainfall southwards. The area that was most alarming and mystifying to climate scientists, so was the decline in east coast rainfall here. And this was due to a different phenomenon. It seems to be, well, the climate modelling people have done indicates that it's due to increasing sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. As those temperatures have increased, the El Niño, the southern oscillation that brings El Niño droughts to Australia, has changed in character. What we're seeing now in Australia are not El Niños of a kind that we saw 30 years ago. Instead, it's a sort of a pseudo-El Niño event, so we get the drought part of the cycle, but the changes, the equivalent changes that normally happen in South America, are not happening quite in sync with what we see here in eastern Australia. The shift essentially has lengthened the drought phase of the Southern Oscillation cycle and made shorter the flood phase of that cycle. And it's that's brought this rainfall deficit to eastern Australia. The computer modelling indicates that as sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean increase further, we'll see an intensification of this phenomenon until at some stage, maybe this century, and if lucky not, the El Niño or the drought phase of the cycle will become permanent over eastern Australia. And that has very profound implications for everyone living in the country. If I could just point out to you that there is not a single large city in Australia that's not suffering water deficit at the moment. If you go to Sydney, which is about here, Australia's largest city, you'll see water police in the streets, and they've got their cars clearly marked water police. They're out prowling for people who are watering their gardens at inappropriate times or washing their cars or whatever else. Our inland cities are in much worse shape, and when I say inland, I mean like about there, right? Not very far inland at all, but there's hardly anyone living in the real inland. The city of Goulburn, for example, which is just where I pointed, is about, I don't know, less than 100 miles from the coast. Last year, its water, it's a city of, I don't know, tens of thousands of people, high tens of thousands. Last year, it became, the water crisis became so concerning that freight trains were used to truck water into that city at enormous cost. So this is an ongoing and very challenging problem for people in Australia. As I said, there's other parts of the world where similar changes in rainfall have occurred, particularly sub-Saharan Africa. So the Darfur crisis is at its base a climate change crisis. It's not necessarily a purely political crisis. The primary motivation, I believe, is those shifts in rainfall across the entire sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, the western parts of the USA. Some parts are still suffering quite significant drought. In this world of ours, everything is connected to everything else. And of course, the atmosphere is the great interconnector. The CO2 that I breathe out now and that you breathe out is mixing around this room, and within weeks we'll be perhaps fertilising a tree on another continent. Just one small example of how things are interconnected. And that warming of the Pacific Ocean has had many profound and some surprising impacts. I should just say on that point that I said at the beginning of this talk that climate change is an air pollution problem. One of the difficulties we face is that the pollutants are invisible and odourless, and we only know them, well, we know them as individual human beings by their manifestations. Their manifestations are so myriad and so profound in some cases that it's been difficult for people to see the grand synthesis, to see the bigger picture of how climate change is affecting our planet. This is one particular aspect of climate change we're looking at here that is rather surprising. As the Pacific Ocean has warmed, the coral reefs in that ocean have begun to die. And initially no one knew what the cause was. It now is very clear that the reefs are dying because of the increased temperatures of the ocean. Coral reefs are built by a symbiotic partnership. The coral polyp that actually lays down the calcium is obviously a core part of it, but it couldn't do that with the help of a partner, which are the small algae plants that live in the cells of the coral polyp. The polyp benefits from the algae because it feeds on the byproducts of photosynthesis that the algae generates. As oceans warm, though, the algae become less able to photosynthesise, and the partnership between the algae and the coral polyp starts to get one-sided. I guess it's like a bad business partnership. And somehow the coral polyp detects this and decides it's costing it more to keep the algae in its cells than it's worth and ejects the algae. Now, presumably that response has evolved as a short-term crisis mechanism. So if a coral's in a little rock pool and it happens to be low tide on a very hot day, it can eject the algae and survive, but then take the algae back in. The problem with the current situation is that the warm temperatures, warm oceans, are remaining for long periods. And if the ocean remains warm for more than a month, the coral just starves to death. The coral organism starves to death. What you're seeing here is a bleached reef, part of the Great Barrier Reef complex. It looks sort of pretty there, but within a couple of months of that dead reef reaching that state, that coral breaks down into a coral rubble and is just covered in a green slime. Now, that's particularly significant for a number of reasons. One is that reefs are biodiverse places. It's estimated that fully a quarter of all marine organisms spend at least some part of their life cycle in coral reefs. So the impacts of these changes for the oceans is very profound. There are five nations on Earth, furthermore, that are utterly dependent upon their coral reefs for their very existence. They're the coral atoll nations. There's probably 750,000 people living in those nations. And to kill their reefs is the equivalent of bulldozing Holland's dikes. The coral atolls won't survive without the reefs. Reefs also generate about $30 billion worth of economic activity worldwide, and a lot of that money goes to people who don't have access to the money economy through other means. So let's just have a look at the incidence of bleaching globally over a longer period of time. This graph is 1870 through to about 2002, and it shows bleaching events here in green. You can see that prior to 1950, when the first biological manifestations of climate change really become evident, that bleaching was a rare event. So this is probably the background natural rate of bleaching. Since then, bleaching has become much more common and widespread. This 1998 event was stupendous. In 1998, between 15 and 20% of the world's coral reefs were either killed outright or severely damaged by bleaching. So it gives you a sense of the scale of these changes. In 2002, the Great Barrier Reef suffered another massive bleaching event. 60% of the barrier reef was either severely damaged or killed. And this year looked as if it was going to deliver what was going to be a death blow for large parts of the reef. Record high water temperatures that had started to damage the reef. And then we had Tropical Cyclone Larry. I don't know whether you heard about that here in the US, but it was a Category 5 cyclone that did enormous damage to the east infrastructure on Australia's east coast, destroyed or damaged 50,000 houses, destroyed agriculture for the year throughout much of that region, but thankfully sucked enough heat out of the ocean to spare the reef from this year's bleaching event. Again, it just says to me that everything is connected to everything else. And as an Australian, I must say I've been watching for the last 5 or 6 years as these bleaching events, or since 98, as the bleaching events have grown, wondering how that heat energy would manifest itself in other ways. And of course, to run a Category 5 cyclone, you need good hot seawater and you need lots of water vapour. So these things are all interconnected. The coral reefs really, in Australia's case, were the canaries in the coal mine as far as extreme weather events and their impacts go. We've already seen the first extinctions brought about by climate change. This is a wonderful little frog called the golden toad. It lived in Costa Rica on mountain summits there, and it had a pretty unusual lifestyle. As you can see, these are males. They're day glow orange, and they would congregate by the hundreds around ponds where the females came to breed. They had, an unusual lifestyle. They'd spend 49 weeks of the year underground, and as you can imagine, the males, when they got to the surface, only had one thing on their mind. To such an extent, they tried to mate with anything that moved. And researchers talked about sort of having to shake them off their boots every now and again as they were watching to count them, because, as I said, anything that moved was fair game. The reason this animal is significant isn't because it's the only animal to have become extinct through climate change or anything like that. It's significant because we actually understand what happened to it. Its entire distribution was in an area that was well studied by biologists, and there was a meteorological station right in that area that gave people virtually hour-by-hour data on what was happening. The species was discovered in 1966, so it's a recently described species. In 1987, as biologists were watching this annual toad orgy that went on, they noticed that it was a great year, as always, I guess, for the toads, until things started to dry out. The ponds the tadpoles were developing in dried out, and there was a total failure of recruitment in the tadpoles. The toads came out to try to breed again, and the same thing happened yet again. The researchers weren't that worried about that because they'd only known about the animal for 20 years, and for all they knew, this was a totally normal event in the life cycle of the species, that some years there would be a failure of recruitment. When they returned next year, they weren't even that worried when they found just a single male toad on the surface. So perhaps that's part of the normal cycle. But when they returned the following year to find only that toad again, that was the only one they could find despite an extensive survey, they did become concerned. And that was the last time anyone saw a golden toad. It took researchers 12 years to really fill in the details of what happened to this species. But effectively, what they managed to establish was that it was again increasing sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean that led to the extinction of the animal. That had changed the way clouds form and sat across Costa Rica, and in that 3-week window when the toads were breeding, there was cloud sitting up against the forest traditionally that brought a lot of moisture. The cloud had become elevated after 1987, way above the forest that the toads inhabited. So although it was cloudy, it was dry. And that change was the single fact that brought about the extinction of this animal. Those forests changed enormously. Lots of other animals were impacted in those forests. But the toad's entire distribution was within them, and so it became totally extinct. When you see extinctions like this of such distinctive animals that you know have taken hundreds of thousands of years to evolve, does send an alarm signal to me that we're changing the world in ways that are rather novel, as you'd imagine from this increased CO2 burden. The Native American Indians, by the way, had some fantastic stories about these toads. They lived lower down the mountain and didn't see the animals very often, but they believed that if anyone was ever lucky enough to find one, that the person would find true happiness. And they tell a story of someone who found a toad and released it back into the forest because they found happiness just too painful to bear. And they tell of another person who was lucky enough to find one who released the animal because he didn't know happiness when he found it. And that guy has to be the everyman for our modern society, I think. We've got this wonderful biodiversity on our planet. We live in a civilization that just brings unparalleled comfort and amenity to us, and yet we're willing to endanger all of that just so we can keep driving big cars and keep not thinking about where our electricity is coming from. I'd like to just have a look at impacts on mountains. Some of the most straightforward science you can do in terms of biological impacts of climate change concern mountains, because mountains get cooler as you go up. And has that ever struck you as being weird? Like, as you climb up a mountain, it gets cooler because you're getting closer to the sun, which is the source of all heat on our planet, ultimately, or pretty much all of it. Just seems a bit weird to me, but anyway. There's reasons for that concern the way the atmosphere works. But as greenhouse gases accumulate in our atmosphere, those cooler mountain summits become reduced, and the cooler conditions become reduced, and the warmth-loving species below start pushing up towards the summit. You people here in the US have already seen some really profound impacts from that change. Pikas, for example, are going extinct all over mountain summits in the western US as their habitat just becomes non-viable. It becomes too warm for the species to survive. Just looking here at Australia again, though, because I know this particular area well, here we have the Great Barrier Reef. Here we have a mountain range that gets up to about 4,500 feet, and it is full of endemic species. There's tens of thousands of species inhabiting this low mountain range. It should be no surprise to us that low mountains have enormous biodiversity. After all, biodiversity takes a long time to evolve, and mountains don't last forever. They wear down over time, right? So low mountains often have a lot of biodiversity on them, and this is an outstanding example of that. This little possum here is just one species of 10,000 I could have pointed to that are unique to these high, cool peaks. Let's have a look at what happens to it as temperatures increase. With 1 degree of additional warming, the species loses about half of its habitat. And that amount of warming is inevitable, no matter what we do, because greenhouse gases last a long time in the atmosphere. The CO2 we're breathing out today, on average, half of it will be there still in a century's time. So as we add to this burden of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, we build in long-term changes that we're just barely becoming aware of. With the average amount of warming that's projected to occur this century, 3.5 degrees, the species becomes extinct, as does pretty much all of those 10,000 species that live on those mountains in northeast Queensland. And I just can't reinforce enough that this single example is emblematic of what will happen around the world. Mountain ranges, low mountain ranges around the world will lose their biodiversity as our planet warms. Desert regions are also vulnerable. This photograph here shows the succulent karoo, which is a South African flora. It is the most diverse desert flora in the world, 2,500 species. It's dependent upon that winter rainfall zone that we saw declining over Western Australia. It's the same rainfall zone in Southern Africa. Changes are so rapid and so profound in this area now that the succulent karoo will simply cease to exist by about 2050. The winter rainfall zone's retracting, and there will be major impacts on this unique flora. It can't retreat south because to the southwards are the Cape Fold Mountains, where the geology is different, and the species simply won't be able to grow there. So again, very, very large scale changes, unexpected changes that indicate that we are changing the world in ways that haven't been seen for a very, very long time indeed. I suppose I should spend some time on human civilization rather than all this wonderful biodiversity. Just have a look at what is already happening to energy structure around the world as the planet warms. You're seeing here emergency cooling of a nuclear reactor in France in 2003. The reason that had to happen was that 2003 was a particularly hot summer in Europe, and river levels had fallen so low that normal cooling couldn't take place. We'll have a look at that summary in more detail in a moment. I don't need to talk at all about the Gulf of Mexico and the damage done there. You know what Hurricane Ivan did to even energy infrastructure, even 90 metres below the surface, just billions of dollars worth of damage. But a less-known example is the Bombay High gas field. There was the most extraordinary monsoons in the Bombay area of India last year, and among the many damages done there was this damage to the Bombay High gas field that you can see below. I'd like to just briefly look at what's happening at the poles and with sea level, because I believe that changes in sea level will become the most damaging changes to our global civilization of all of the things that we can imagine at the moment. Oh, sorry. Good. This is the Antarctic Peninsula here, so South America's up here. This is the Larsen B ice shelf, which broke up rather abruptly in two phases, 1995 and then over a few weeks in 2002. Scientists learnt a great deal about changes at the poles and its implications for sea level by watching this event. The first thing that we should realise is that ice, being beautiful, bright stuff, reflects a lot of sunlight back into space, and that's sunlight that doesn't get to warm our planet. So nice, fresh, crisp ice will reflect 90% of sunlight back into space, sunlight that doesn't heat our planet. Dark ocean, which you can see here, does the opposite. It absorbs 90% of the sun's energy that hits the surface of our planet and heats the ocean. Now, these abrupt breakups like this change nice bright ice for dark ocean. So they change the heat balance of the poles, and they enhance the warming effect. After the breakup, scientists were able to drill into the sediments below where the ice sheet was and discovered that that ice sheet had been stable for 12,000 years prior to its abrupt breakup. The breakup wasn't really evident on the surface of the ice sheet. It was rather surprising to people when it did break up. And the reason was that the breakup was caused by a slight warming of these Weddell deep waters here. These waters are still cold enough to kill you in minutes if you fall into them, but they had warmed fractionally, and that warming had allowed the ocean to eat away at the base of the ice plane, propagating cracks and crevices and fissures that allowed it to break up abruptly, as you see there in the late summer of 2002. Scientists also learned that the glaciers that fed into this area, coming off the land, sped up enormously once that ice sheet had broken up. The ice sheet was acting like a dam holding those glaciers back. And that's particularly important because the ice sheet itself, when it broke up, didn't contribute to rises in sea level. It's just like melting an ice cube in a glass of water. It won't raise the level of liquid in the glass. But all of these glaciers, of course, contain land ice, and as they contribute to the ocean, they do have an impact on sea level. This ice sheet was about the size of Luxembourg, about 1,200 square miles. It didn't have a huge impact on sea level, but down over here is a much bigger ice sheet, the Amundsen Ice Plain, which is now looks to be in breakup mode. We won't know whether it's in full breakup mode for the next 2 or 3 years. It holds back enough ice to raise global sea levels by 1.3 metres. And I should just point out to you that the last time our world was as warm as it's projected to be by the middle of this century, and that was about 115,000 years ago, sea levels were 4 metres higher than they are today. So I do think this is a particularly serious issue that we need to keep an eye on. Down here is the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is even larger. It has enough ice locked up and held back by it to raise global sea levels by about 20 feet or 6 to 7 metres. And you start a domino effect with this. Break off one ice sheet, you change the heat balance, break up the next one, the heat balance changes further, and so on. Just like to briefly recap on some of the events that climate scientists have linked to the warming that's been seen over the 20th century. We've had 0.63 of a degree of warming, and these are just a list of events which relate to that. We've talked about most of them, the 1998 El Niño event, drought in the western USA, particularly northwestern, rainfall deficits across Australia, Larsen B, should be Hurricane Mitch. I did this for an Australian audience. We call hurricanes cyclones. Second most severe on record. Of course, there's been a lot more hurricane activity just in the last 12 months. The rate of CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere going up from 1.8 parts per million in the 20th century to 2.54 in 2003. That exceptionally warm European summer killed 36,000 people. I was surprised as I researched this that heat waves are more deadly than hurricanes in terms of their impact on human populations. And the reason for that is that a lot of younger and older people just have trouble maintaining their body temperature within a viable range when things get too hot. So these heat waves are deadly events that again need to concern us. Hurricanes appearing in areas where they haven't been seen before, and we all saw what happened in 2005, Florida. Scientists widely believe that there's a tipping point in the way the climate system regulates itself, and this we may well face runaway warming by the time we accumulate 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which will equate to about 2 degrees of warming. The implications of that include loss of the North Polar ice cap, although the latest studies suggest that we may not have to wait that long to see a full breakup of the North Polar ice cap in summer. That may occur sometime between 2020 and 2100, and of course will have pretty profound implications for the heat balance of the planet as a whole. Biodiversity loss in all isolated natural areas. In times past when there's been dramatic climate change, species have been able to migrate. So on this continent of North America, when the ice sheets melted, the temperature increased by about 5 degrees Celsius over 7,000 years. And that scale and rate of change was such that it allowed trees to migrate. Now, trees that grow in Canada today, at the time when the ice was there, were living in northern Florida. So they had a whole continent to migrate across to find their zone of thermal comfort. Today there's a lot of people on the planet, and biodiversity is mostly in national parks. I'm one of those people who fought really hard for the creation of national parks in Australia. I now reluctantly accept that unless we can get on top of this problem, all I've done is create a series of death traps for biodiversity. Species won't be able to migrate to find areas that they're comfortable in. The largest national park in the world is Kruger National Park in Africa. It's the size of Israel. Studies done there suggest that 60% of its species will be lost with just a couple of degrees of warming. So big, big and very unfortunate impacts. We've looked at mountain rainforests, we've looked at coral reefs. Phase shifts in climate, perhaps we can talk about that in question time, just to save some time here. As I've mentioned, large rises in sea level. Why am I concerned about large rises in sea level? First and foremost, that we live in a global civilization. A lot of the amenity that you and I enjoy in the world is the result of global cooperation. We've created this extraordinary telekinetic organ called a global civilization. It's a telekinetic organ of our planet. Changes in one part have instantaneous impacts on another part, as we all know. But the thing that knits our global civilization together is sea trade. And if we do face a 4 metre rise in sea level, imagine the implications for keeping port structure open around the world. And just put yourself in the position of a port engineer who is tasked with keeping port facilities open as sea levels rise. If we could tell the port engineer exactly how much sea levels were going to rise, things would be fine. I'm sure they could cope. The truth of the matter is we won't know. We won't know what the new stabilisation point's going to be for our oceans. I'd like to just look at solutions now and how quickly we have to act in order to avert some of the damage that's going to be caused by climate change. I've just put together here a little bit of a carbon budget. And the way this works is that you've got to look at accumulation of CO2 in the atmosphere over time to get to this point of 450 parts per million. Now, today we've put that much carbon in the atmosphere, so we have that much left in our budget before we reach 450 parts per million. The rate of emissions is such that by 2020, current rates of accumulation, we will have used more than half of the budget, and by 2040, we will be out of carbon budget. Now, it takes a long time to turn around energy infrastructure. The average turnaround time for motor vehicles in the US, I believe, is about 13 years. The average time for power utility infrastructure is 50 years. This tells us we need to start acting now rather than wait for 2020, 2040 to act. It also reinforces the point that I really want to make here, that when I started looking at this issue, I wasn't quite sure what sort of an issue climate change was. I thought maybe it's a scientific issue, you know, maybe it's a economic issue first and foremost, or even a political one. I now believe it's none of those. It's first and foremost a moral issue for everyone, because we are the generation that has to actually make the changes. It's today's business leaders and today's consumers that have to actually start making these changes. It's not something that can be handed on. It's also a moral issue because, of course, it is directly related to the way we affect the world around us, as any moral issue does. How can we make these large cuts in our in the pollution stream that we all put into the atmosphere? This work's done by the International Energy Agency, and they've looked at how we can contribute to CO2 reductions in the next few decades. The big red part of the pie chart there, the 58%, relates to end use efficiency gains. And that means doing things like selling your SUV and buying a hybrid fuel car. If you do that, just that one example, let's take, you'll be cutting your emissions from transport by 70% in one day rather than the 35 years that we have to achieve emissions reductions on that scale. And 70% is about what we need to aim at in order to stabilise our climate. You can see here the other 20% of the graph, increased renewables in power generation. I don't think these are the best figures, by the way, available, but they give us some indication. Another 10% from nuclear energy, and another 13-odd% from switching fuels and in the way we deal with fossil fuels as a whole. I think I'm pretty much out of time now. I'm going to just stop and leave you with this image of the North Pole, which is self-explanatory, and the caption, which is, what I see as the point we're at today. So thank you very much. Happy to close.